So we don't think there's a federal claim there either.
The state fights Joe Miller's court challenge. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 12th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, allegations but scant evidence of voter fraud in the U.S. Senate race.
It's like saying that in the seventh inning of a baseball game, there have only been 21 outs. Where are the other six?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
The thicket of litigation surrounding this year's write-in campaign just got a little thicker. This week, federal judge John Sedgwick removed himself from a case filed by Republican candidate Joe Miller, challenging how write-in ballots are counted. Now the state is challenging that suit, saying Miller can't file against the write-in count in a federal court. KSK's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Joe Miller filed suit against Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell and the Alaska Division of Elections in federal court in Anchorage early this week, charging that Alaska election officials are misinterpreting a state law that says that a write-in candidate's name must be spelled exactly as it appears on the candidate's write-in declaration. Judge John Sedgwick was scheduled to hear the case in U.S. District Court, but stepped down, saying that prior encounters with Miller had left him with a negative impression of the man. In 2004, Sedgwick was the chief federal judge in Alaska, and Miller was a part-time federal magistrate in Fairbanks. Sedgwick said Miller quit the Fairbanks position with barely any notice that year. Miller's lawsuit was handed over to U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Bison, who dismissed Miller's request for an immediate injunction against the state counting any ballot for Lisa Murkowski with a misspelled name. The judge also required the plaintiffs and the defendants, in this case the state, to address the jurisdictional issue of where the case should be heard. Now the state is urging the federal courts to dismiss Miller's case, saying that state courts are the proper venue. State Assistant Attorney General Margaret Patton Walsh has filed a motion to dismiss the case entirely.
Well, we filed a motion to dismiss for lack of federal question jurisdiction. It's a common practice for the state to challenge federal jurisdiction when what's at issue is purely a state law claim. The issue here is that the Division of Elections is misinterpreting a state statute, and so this case belongs in state court.
Miller's case links the issue to the United States Constitution's Elections Clause, which gives the state legislature the authority to determine how elections are held for federal offices. Miller's suit also cites the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protections Clause under the 14th Amendment. But Patton Walsh says Alaska's election standards apply statewide.
What we have here is one election official for the entire state applying a consistent standard, and that creates no equal protection problem of any kind. So we don't think there's a federal claim there either.
Patton Walsh accuses Miller of, quote, forum shopping. She says the case would be more appropriate for the Alaska Supreme Court, which would be the expert on Alaska election law. Patton Walsh says Alaska's legislature has given the State Division of Elections the authority to supervise conduct of state elections. Briefing in the case is set for next week. Miller attorney Thomas Van Flyn did not return calls for this story. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The latest results from the Division of Elections this afternoon show Lisa Murkowski is now getting, without any challenges, more than 90% of the write-in votes cast last week in her bid to keep her seat in the U.S. Senate. Observers for Republican nominee Joe Miller have challenged another 9% of the votes, but most of those have been turned down by state elections officials. Those 4,300 challenged ballots could end up being recounted in court if Miller decides to contest the results. At issue is whether Murkowski's name is perfectly written, spelled correctly, and legibly. So far, after nearly 3 days of counting, only 828 ballots have been rejected for being improper. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
State law requires that for a write-in vote to count, the name on the ballot must be the same as that on the candidate declaration filed with the Division of Elections. Joe Miller's campaign staff insist there can be no deviation. Floyd Brown's a Miller campaign advisor who's nationally known for his visceral political activities, currently pushing to impeach Barack Obama. Brown met reporters in Juneau wearing a purple wristband with Lisa Murkowski printed on it. The Murkowski campaign had bought and distributed 75,000 of them this fall. Brown held his hand high, showing the band.
I'm going to suggest a standard that we can all agree on. And this is it, right here. This is a standard that Lisa Murkowski spent millions of dollars asking people to write in. This is a standard that she printed cards with. This is the standard that she printed these neat armbands with. This is the standard by which she asked the voters of Alaska to write her name in. And that's the simple standard that we want to be used in this election.
However, the state is using a definition from legal precedents, decisions made by the Alaska Supreme Court in several cases since statehood. The courts have interpreted the statute to include the voter's intention, not a vote based on perfect spelling or handwriting. Elections Director Gail Funumiai says if she can phonetically pronounce the name based on the handwriting she sees, it will count. Ben Ginsburg is an attorney known nationally for leading the legal process in the Florida recount of the 2000 presidential election, and more recently, the 2008 Minnesota race that saw Democrat Al Franken enter the U.S. Senate 8 months after that election. He's in Juneau on Murkowski's behalf and says the courts nationally and in Alaska are trending towards determining the voter's intention.
The object of voting is to enfranchise people. The object of voting is to have participation by the community in selecting their elected officials. People did that to an extraordinary degree to actually write the name on this ballot. And so I think it was probably a surprise to the Miller forces about how clean these ballots look, but they'll now have to be arguing that those Alaskans who may have put a C instead of a K or whose handwriting was a little bit illegible for whatever reason should be disenfranchised. I think that's unlikely.
From the counting floor, observers say they're seeing Miller observers beginning to make fewer challenges to write-in votes that seem to be perfect. The count is going slowly. The Division of Elections says it will definitely last into the weekend and could extend into next week. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Miller volunteer advisor Floyd Brown just held another press conference at the write-in count site where he made more suggestions of voter fraud and election irregularities. Yesterday, Brown suggested possible voter fraud and intimidation in Alaska's U.S. Senate race. However, he offered little in the way of evidence, giving one specific instance of possible voting irregularity, a sworn affidavit from a Republican poll watcher in Fairbanks. Rocky McDonald complained of an unsecure ballot box at the Tanana Valley Fairgrounds on Election Day. He also claimed the voting machine jammed several times and its counter malfunctioned for about an hour and a half. Brown presented three more sworn affidavits alleging impropriety on Election Day. And at the count site, where Joe Miller observers are now saying some ballots cast for Lisa Murkowski appear to be written in the same handwriting, Brown also continued to suggest that the number of write-in votes cast on Election Day don't match the number being counted in the room. Murkowski spokesman Kevin Sweeney says it's an ongoing process.
It's like saying that in the seventh inning of a baseball game, there have only been 21 outs. Where are the other six?
Floyd did not provide reporters with copies of the affidavits, but Miller spokesman Randy DeSoto said they'd be available in a press release later. Miller's campaign is suing the state, seeking access to election registers from more than 30 Alaska precincts to ensure there was no voter fraud or irregularities in those areas. The lawsuit filed today says the campaign wants to count and inspect signatures to ensure there was no possible fraud, mistake, irregularity, or inconsistencies. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making the case for science studies in the Arctic.
If offshore is going to happen in the Arctic, that it's done with the world-class standards that are the best possible.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The recent announcement that the North Slope Borough had signed an agreement with Shell to conduct multi-year science studies in the Arctic may be the first ever attempt at such a collaboration. Borough Mayor Edward Itta says the objectives are to get solid baseline science collected on the largely unstudied Arctic waters off Barrow's coast. Itta says the agreement creates a steering committee that will guide the direction of what should be studied. Itta will appoint a steering committee member from each of the North Slope Borough villages, Point Lay, Point Hope, Wainwright, Nuiqsut, Barrow, and the Barter Island community of Kaktovik. Itta will also select four independent scientists. Shell will also have appointees. Itta says the announcement by Bureau of Ocean Energy Management head Michael Broomwich that a decision would be coming soon on Arctic development concerns him.
Yes, I am concerned, but it's only because if a decision is made too soon, I don't know that it will include our concerns and recognize that we, the Inupiaq people, are in the North Slope, are the only people that will have to live with the long-term impacts of whatever happens out in our ocean. So the issue now of an impending decision soon, yes, concerns me very much.
Are there parts of the agreement that you're most pleased with and other areas that you weren't so happy about but had to compromise on?
The proprietary issues was a long, lengthy one, and I'm pleased in the end that both sides have agreed that this will be open and that data information coming out will be open for peer review. And that's a good thing, I think. What I've been disappointed about a little bit, I guess, is the length of time it took to reach where we are. This is a frontier. There's never really been anything done on this scale up here before. So very often, you know, we've had to rely exclusively on scientists and various experts because sometimes we didn't even know the right questions to ask or what areas should be being focused on.
Mayor Itta, did it feel at all like sort of working with the fox to protect the hen house?
I suppose that perception is out there, and I don't know that that's the case. I don't believe it is, because I know exactly where Shell is coming from, and they know where I'm coming from. It's no secret I've been opposed to offshore, so that's nothing new. You know, I'm not surprised at all that now, starting with the New York Times, that they've started a national ad campaign to build support for offshore drilling. And that's their goal. I don't think that's a secret at all. That's what they do. My goal has always been and will always be to make sure that if offshore is going to happen in the Arctic, that it's done with the world-class standards that are the best possible.
Point Hope says they're not happy with the agreement. I'm sure that's no surprise to you. Although Native Village President Caroline Cannon says she knows getting science is important, but she says she feels like their concerns are ignored, and she worries that signing an agreement with Shell means inching toward an agreement on development. What do you think about that? How do you respond to Point Hope's concerns?
I share Point Hope's concerns about the need for a better understanding of our ocean and the marine wildlife that we depend on before we go forward. And that's what this agreement is all about. It does not suggest that we are signing off on anything. It's a joint science agreement and nothing more. I believe that this agreement is an example of how we can get them more involved in deciding what questions are studied and looked at than we've ever had before, because I don't believe there's any process in place right now to do that. For people who think I'm selling out or are concerned, I just want to assure them that if somebody has a better idea out there, instead of just filing lawsuits and saying no, I sure want to hear about it, because I believe this is the most constructive way to try to get our needs addressed in a meaningful way.
Edward Itta is the mayor of the North Slope Borough. The Pew Environmental Group has released a large report that takes a detailed look at the challenges of preventing and containing oil spills in the Arctic Ocean. KDLG's Mike Mason looked it over and has the story.
The new study is called Oil Spill Prevention and Response in the U.S. Arctic Ocean: Unexamined Risks, Unacceptable Consequences. The report was commissioned on behalf of the Pew Environment Group, which is labeling the report as the most comprehensive analysis yet on the challenges to preventing and containing oil spills along the nation's northernmost coast. Marilyn Hyman is the director of the Pew Environment Group's U.S. Arctic program. She says the Arctic is the next region of the U.S. slated for offshore oil and gas exploration and development.
It is a remote, extreme, and fragile place, and is an extremely challenging place to mount a response to a major oil spill. It's extreme. The Arctic Ocean experiences moving ice, punishing sub-zero temperatures, brutal storms with hurricane-force winds, and at times seas reaching up to 30 feet.
The new report comes on the heels of the massive Gulf of Mexico oil spill earlier this year, but it was stressed several times during the press conference that the Gulf of Mexico is a hugely different environment than the Arctic. Hyman says that the Arctic poses many challenges that were not present in the Gulf of Mexico.
Even in temperate waters, where there's major infrastructure and equipment and vessels readily available, the response was woefully inadequate. We need to heed the lessons of the BP Deepwater Horizon spill. We cannot gamble with the Arctic Ocean. We have to be fully prepared.
The new report includes four recommendations. Hyman says federal resource management agencies must complete a comprehensive science plan before any oil and gas exploration and development can proceed.
Many studies have been conducted, yet we know very little about the food web in the Arctic ecosystem, and we have incomplete knowledge of most Arctic marine species.
The second recommendation included in the report is that oil spill risk assessments and spill prevention technologies must reflect Arctic conditions. The third recommendation is that spill response must be tailored to the Arctic conditions and response planning standards must be strengthened. The new report was actually prepared by the NUCA Research and Planning Group, which has offices in Plymouth, Massachusetts and Seldovia, Alaska. Tim Robertson is the group's general manager, and he was one of the co-authors of the new report. One of the controversial tools used to respond to the spill in the Gulf of Mexico was dispersants, which are intended to break up the oil. Robertson says the jury is still out on how effective dispersants actually were in the Gulf.
And I'm very curious as we get into the actual documentation of what the effects were as the papers start to get published. I think the injection of dispersants at depth is very controversial and would be very controversial in the Arctic as well. Typically, dispersants don't work as well in cold water. While they have been proposed for the Arctic, there isn't any conclusive proof at this time that they're a valid technology.
While not officially included in the recommendation section of the new report, Hyman suggested that the U.S. Senate pass a bill related to offshore oil and gas development during the upcoming lame duck session that starts on Monday.
This legislation would go a long way to reform offshore drilling laws. The House has acted, several committees in the Senate have passed oil spill legislation, and a package is ready to be moved to the Senate floor for a vote. As the spill fades from our minds, it will be harder and harder to pass effective reforms.
The new report is 137 pages long. The report was commissioned by the Pew Environment Group, which is the conservation arm of the Pew Charitable Trusts. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
There's a town in the south of Peru called Montarani, and at first glance, it might not appear to have a lot in common with Bethel or the Kuskokwim River. But both cities have regional ports, and both are part of large and diverse watersheds, the Kuskokwim for Bethel, the Amazon for Montarani. And through years of trial and error, Kuskokwim mariners have come to use the tidal information from Montarani to estimate when the tides will be coming and going in Bethel. But now Bethel will get its own tide station. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
If you got a boat that's drawing too much water, you've got to wait for the water to come in to get the tide.
Pete Williams is the director for the Port of Bethel.
A lot of times you see barges that are anchored out down below Oscarville Crossing is a problem. You'll see barges anchored out down there, and what they're doing is waiting for enough water to get over these shallow spots.
To approximate, tide forecasters adjusted forecasts from locations hundreds of miles away, like Dillingham and Clark's Point.
We found out by trial and error that what we were receiving in these small books, all of us that worked on the water knew it wasn't right.
Williams says mariners picked up on something. Bethel tides were mirroring the tides of Matarani, Peru. But because Matarani is in the southern hemisphere, 12 hours need to be added to come up with a good estimate for the Bethel tide. But for truly accurate tides, most drivers use their own observations.
If you're out here on the river every day like these tugboats, so you kind of get a feel for it. But for somebody that just jumps and goes out maybe once a week, it's kind of hard to get a feel what this tide's doing.
Now the city of Bethel will be purchasing a tide station with a grant award from the Department of Homeland Security. The station will provide real-time information about the tide, and Williams says the city can make that public. As time goes on, tidal forecasters will have more information than ever before.
Eventually, all this data will get compiled over a number of years, and we'll come out with some accurate predictions.
And for Bethel, Matarani will become just another city of many in South America. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Nana Regional Corporation shareholders will be receiving their annual dividend from business earnings over the next several days. Nana CFO Kevin Thomas says most of the original shareholders have 200 shares because all of the Nana Region Village Corporations, with the exception of Kotzebue Village Corporation, have combined with the main Regional Corp, so original shareholders have more shares. Thomas says the dividend amount is $14 per share.
So those shareholders that have 200 shares would get $2,800.
Thomas says this year's amount is a dollar per share higher than last year. In 1991, Nana elected to enroll children, what are sometimes called afterborns, descendants who were born after December 17, 1971, and were left off the original rolls. Those children have, on average, 100 shares and also receive dividend payments. He says the 12,000 shareholders will start seeing their dividend checks soon. Electronic distribution started last night, and paper checks are going in the mail starting today. Nana pays their dividend on an annual basis. Next week's rocket launch at the Kodiak Launch Complex on Narrow Cape will be packed with 7 payloads for more than a dozen different experiments. NASA scientists and military project managers held a briefing Tuesday morning in advance of the November 19th liftoff. KMXT's Jacob Resnick tried to make sense of it all.
S-26 mission represents the first Minotaur launch from the Kodiak Launch Complex.
This will be the first launch for the Minotaur 4 vehicle from the Kodiak Launch Complex.
Briefings by scientists across the country underscored the amount of time, effort, and money that has gone into preparing for next week's launch at the Kodiak Launch Complex. How much money specifically? Officials acted stumped by the question, though they gave their assurances that they're being careful with taxpayer dollars. Here's Mission Commander Colonel Michael Moran of Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico.
With
our objective of making sure we maximize the taxpayers' resources, we want to just use every ounce of payload capability on those large rockets to the benefit of our overall space test program objectives.
The roles of the experiments are varied. Packed into the 75-foot Minotaur 4 rocket are seven independent payloads. The Minotaur 4 rocket is the product of a plowshare program that's renovated ICBMs into launch vehicles for satellites. It will be the first launch on Kodiak Island since 2008. According to Colonel Moran, launching from Kodiak has some advantages despite its relative isolation in the Gulf of Alaska.
Having launched out of both Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg Air Force Base, I can tell you that the demands of the Alaskan environment are a very robust launch infrastructure and launch pad. And that's exactly what we have up at the Kodiak Launch Complex.
The smallest of the experiments is the NanoCell D. It's a solar sail that would harness streaming solar particles from the sun, much in the same way a ship's sail harnesses the wind. The NanoCell D is one of the six experiments contained within the FASTSAT. It's a long acronym, but it's a system for packing in multiple satellites into a single payload, explains NASA's project manager Mark Boudreau.
There is a first on this mission. We have integrated into this mission six experiments, the most that had ever been done in a Class D spacecraft of this type were two experiments on a flight.
11 of the 16 experiments are specifically for the military and developed and directed by the U.S. Air Force. Many are sensors designed to improve understanding of conditions in space that affect communication between ground stations and satellites, but one non-military experiment of note is designed to study life in space. Astrobiologist Pascal Ehrenfreund says for the first time, scientists would be able to monitor the growth of bacteria in real time in a way that's never been done before.
And we really would like to understand, you know, the effects of microgravity and ionizing radiation and how those organisms respond. And so there's an additional possibility to study the effect of radiation.
The launch is set for November 19th. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Jacob Resnick in Kodiak. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. From Kodiak to Kosiglik to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.